From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1953, when the Doomsday Clock was set at 2 minutes to midnight. The Doomsday Clock is supposed to be a symbol of scientific concern about the possibility that mankind will cease to exist. It goes back to 1947. Now, what could the extinction be from? It could be because of war, climate change, something else. In 1953, the United States and the Soviet Union tested nuclear weapons on the same day. Manhattan Project scientist Eugene Rabinowitz said, quote, "The time when each major nation will hold the power of destroying at will the urban civilization of any other nation is close at hand," end quote. The Doomsday Clock has been adjusted many times over the subsequent years. As the New York Times reports, the clock has moved ever closer to midnight in the past decade, set to 11:55 in 2012, 11:57 in 2015, and last year, 2.5 minutes to midnight. 2 weeks ago, the clock was adjusted again, this time to 11:58, the closest to midnight since the nuclear testing in 1953. Scientists say there are many reasons, but chief among them are concerns about nuclear war and the lack of action on climate change. This hour, a conversation not just about the clock, but what it means to be sitting at a time of 11:58, according to international scientists. What are the actual concerns that we face when it comes to nuclear weaponry, international relations, possible war, climate, and more? My guests include in studio Tom Weber, assistant professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Welcome to the program, Tom. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And also on the line with us is Wes Renfro, chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. Wes, welcome back to the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Good afternoon.
I want to go ahead and read, if I could, the statement that came from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists that came with the release a couple of weeks ago about setting the clock to 11:58. This is as reported by the New York Times. Quote, "In 2017, world leaders failed to respond effectively to the looming threats of nuclear war and climate change, making the world security situation more dangerous than it was a year ago, and as dangerous as it has been since World War II. It cited the risks from North Korea's nuclear program, discord between Russia and the United States, tensions in the South China Sea, the buildup of the nuclear arsenals of Pakistan and India, and uncertainty over the Iran nuclear deal. And the scientists also warned that the sustained reductions in greenhouse gases needed to prevent disastrous warming of the planet had not yet occurred, and cited the dangers that technology disruption is causing for democracies, including disinformation campaigns intended to manipulate elections and undermine confidence in democracy." So those are the main drivers of this. There's a lot to work with there, but I want to start with Wes. They put a lot of emphasis on nuclear proliferation, but not just as a deterrent. So to you, does it make sense to you? Do you put stock in what this the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists does with the Doomsday Clock, and does it concern you, Wes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really important to remember that we have increased proliferation in places like South Asia, Northeast Asia, and there's a lot of uncertainty over the fate of the Iran deal. And if you read the statement from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists closely, they specifically say that they are worried that the Iran nuke deal will fall apart and that Tehran will be incentivized to further its nuke ambitions. And so I do think that there's some very good reasons to be alarmed about the state of affairs right now.
I want to listen to two different remarks that President Trump made about nuclear weaponry. The first from the recent State of the Union address. Here's President Trump talking about nuclear arsenals.
"As part of our defense, we must modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal, hopefully never having to use it, but making it so strong and so powerful that it will deter any acts of aggression by any other nation or anyone else. Perhaps someday in the future, there will be a magical moment when the countries of the world will get together to eliminate their nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, we are not there yet, sadly."
All right, that's President Trump at the State of the Union. But here is the president back in November to talking to North Korea. Essentially, he's making a statement aimed at North Korea. He was addressing South Korea's National Assembly when he said this in November.
"This is a very different administration than the United States has had in the past. Today, I hope I speak not only for our countries, but for all civilized nations. When I say to the North, do not underestimate us and do not try us. We will defend our common security, our shared prosperity, and our sacred liberty. We did not choose to draw here on this peninsula.
That's President Trump talking to, making a statement directly toward North Korea. And right around that time, he was on Twitter saying that my button is bigger than Kim Jong-un's button. So, Wes Renfro, what do you make of those statements you heard from the president?
So it's interesting in that the underlying theme isn't new or novel. The basic concepts that the president has espoused would be familiar to those folks who know Harry Truman or Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan well. What is interesting is the sort of vulgarity, the comments about the size of the nuke button. I think that has inspired a lot of concern about how he views nukes. Maybe they are something that can be used rather than just a deterrent. But the overall nuke posture of the United States actually isn't fundamentally different in this administration as opposed to previous administrations.
Okay. And he's saying that there is a difference there. And it was on MSNBC that Joe Scarborough reported about a year ago that there were private conversations the president had with his advisors in which he was saying, well, why can't we use nukes? We have them. Now, the White House has denied that. And that remains, as far as I know, an unconfirmed report. So, Wes, do you view this administration as having roughly the same disposition toward nuclear weaponry as previous ones?
So I obviously can't comment on what was going through the president's head, but the administration in its totality has been pretty consistent on the role of nuke weapons in the overall strategic constellation of the United States. That's a different question than whether or not this particular president would be willing to use them. And on that latter question, of course, I have no special insight since I don't actually know the president.
Okay. Well, and do you have any special concern, though, that this is an administration that views nuclear weaponry at all more loosely than previous ones, at all more recklessly? Or do you think at the end of the day, when if there is a crisis, when a crisis arrives, that the General Mattises of the world, that the McMasters, that the people surrounding the president will make sure that we are not the ones starting a preemptive nuclear war, that we are not using weaponry in sort of a first strike capacity?
I do worry and actually have some pretty serious concerns. You know, folks who study nuke strategy have long worried about accidental escalation, that loose comments or ill-conceived, smallish decisions could rapidly turn into global catastrophe. And with this president's penchant for speaking off the cuff, for perhaps not thinking things through very carefully, for disregarding expert advice, I am quite concerned about a scenario in which something that perhaps seems trivial could rapidly spin out of control and be very dangerous for not only Americans, but for people globally.
For those who were voting in the 2016 election and were thinking on that global scale and thinking about children and grandchildren and thinking about a world in which no one wants to see nuclear weapons used, do you think we are now in a world where it is more or less likely that nuclear weapons are going to be used again?
You know, I don't really know how to answer that. There's a lot of forces that suggest that there's a pretty strong nuke taboo. But of course, there are people who don't believe in that. And there are scenarios under which I can imagine that the United States or the other international actors would use nukes. One thing that I'll add that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was pretty clear about is that their concern in 2018 is not only about climate change and nuke proliferation, but also the general drift of Washington away from its traditional leadership position post-World War II, the sort of weakening of the institutions that bind people together into a community of nations. And that's a domain of activity that I'm actually quite concerned about with this particular administration.
All right. So we're going to come back to that subject in a moment with Wes Renfro, who's on the line with us, the chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. We'll also invite our listeners to join the program and let us know what you think about this. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. What are your biggest concerns? And do you think that we have truly changed in really the last year? It was interesting. Ross Douthat of the New York Times, Wes, has said often that He thinks there's a strange disconnect that he has never seen before, Wes. Douthat says, this is a president who, if he were taken seriously, his repeated comments that are reckless, that are juvenile, that are sort of provocative, would spark a crisis every other week. But Douthat says he clearly isn't taken seriously, because when he's riffing about the size of a nuclear button or those kinds of things, people just kind of shrug now and they kind of move on. And I think Ross was just writing that he finds that remarkable on its face, that no one really believes crisis is imminent because no one takes him seriously. What do you think?
You know, I think that's actually the most remarkable feature about the Trump presidency in general, the degree to which the president makes statements that are either untrue or folks willingly discard. But when we apply that to the prospect of nuke war, that's actually a really, really dangerous outcome, because so much of nuke strategy rests on the willingness of other international actors to believe the statements that you make. Are you in fact credible? And that's not only talking about sort of potential adversaries, but also our allies to whom we have pledged that we will keep safe. And so this loose talk or this novelty in his speech and in his tweets, I would argue, is in fact quite dangerous.
Yeah, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, in their decision to update the doomsday clock to 11:58, said, quote, neither allies nor adversaries have been able to reliably predict U.S. actions or understand when U.S. pronouncements are real and when they are mere rhetoric. And they added, to call the world nuclear situation dire is to understate the danger and its immediacy. So they think the unpredictability is a real problem, and it is undermining safety and security in the United States and around the world. I'll get your phone calls in a second. I see the phone ringing, but let me first turn to Tom Weber, a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, for a look at the climate change piece of this. So part of what the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists say is we're updating the doomsday clock because there's been a lack of action on climate. Is that roughly your estimate in the last year? Has there been a lack of action from the United States and around the world on this?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it is really important to note that the climate part of this equation was not due to any new information about climate change itself, no major revision of our estimates of climate change. It's really just this lack of action. There've been a couple major factors, of course. The decision of the Trump administration to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord and the knock-on effects that's going to have with other countries. But then also just the broader kind of politicization of the climate issue. Never has that been more apparent, I think, than in the last year, is that the public appetite to deal with climate change has become embroiled in a whole partisan political system.
And so, Tom, how do you view the kind of the fine line that I think some political leaders before this president, President Obama among them, have tried to walk, and I think some scientists try to walk? And I say a fine line in that the importance to communicate to the public that this is becoming dire without sounding sort of cartoonishly apocalyptic. Or maybe we should sound cartoonishly apocalyptic. But I think what I'm trying to kind of get at is the public doesn't seem to take it seriously if it sounds ridiculous, because it's hard on a day-to-day basis to see the results of climate change, even though they are happening. So how do you view the importance of making those distinctions and communicating the threat?
Yeah, so this is obviously a major issue. As a scientist, my inclination is always just to stick to the facts. The facts may not sound apocalyptic to the, you know, regular person hearing them for the first time. The fact that the climate has, we think, warmed by about a degree C since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution certainly doesn't sound like the end of the world. And therefore, as a scientist, we're not going to blow that up to sound more apocalyptic than it really is. But I think you have to drill down more into the details of what that degree C warming means and the next maybe 3 or 4 degrees C warming that we might see by the end of the century if no action is taken. If you drill down into some of the details of what that means for sea level rise, general changes in the climate system that will affect us, extreme precipitation events, extreme weather events, like some of the ones we've seen over the last years. I think there's a lot of details in there that even without blowing it up and going over the top, there's details that would concern the average person, I think, if those details are presented correctly.
Sure, and again, when you use a term like doomsday clock, and we talk about extinction, and we talk about climate change, one of the terms that climate activists use, one of the phrases is, you know, sort of save the planet. And one of your colleagues at the University of Rochester, Adam Frank, is going to have a discussion when his book comes out this summer that takes a fresh look at how we communicate climate science and how everyone can kind of have a stake in a better future for it. But one of the things he said recently is, the planet does not need saving. Mankind needs saving. The planet will be here one form or another. It just may not be all that habitable by living things like us. Do you agree with that?
Whoa, that's a big question. I think the interesting thing about climate change and the way it factors into this whole doomsday clock discussion is not that we expect the direct effects of climate change to kind of wipe us off the planet. We don't expect the Earth is just going to be too hot to support human life. Obviously, there's very warm places on Earth that do support human life. The way it's factored into the doomsday clock is the way that climate change might make things like international conflicts more likely, right? As the climate changes, things like food security are going to become an issue. And, you know, countries that rely on particular crops that are adapted to their local climate state, they're going to see their food security undermined. So there's facets of climate change that will likely make human conflict a more likely prospect. And I think that's generally how climate change factors into this, you know, end of the world extinction conversation.
I think that is such an interesting point, because I think often we do think of that first scenario that Tom presented, that all of a sudden the planet is just uninhabitable, and maybe eventually it gets there over a longer period of time.
Yeah, and habitability is going to be felt on much more regional scales than the global scale, right? There's certain places that are already facing very extreme consequences of climate change. Low-lying island nations, for instance, are going to be most strongly affected by sea level rise, by massive changes in precipitation. And there are island nations like that where people are already being displaced by those things. In countries like the United States, where we have the resources to kind of adapt to the change in climate, you know, it's unlikely that climate change is going to directly make this, you know, the United States uninhabitable for us.
And this is where Wes Renfro, I think Tom is bringing up an interesting point that maybe doesn't get brought up enough when it comes to climate. If climate is viewed in a silo, you can sort of mistake the point that when there is instability, if there is insecurity, if there's food insecurity, if there's drought or famine, that those conditions do ripen the possibility of conflict, of uprising, of international conflict and war. Can you speak to how you view that in terms of climate as a component of international security?
Yeah, so Thomas is exactly right. I think that most folks have a reductionist view of conflict as state A attacking state B for whatever reason, but they miss the host of intervening variables, things like changes in migration, lack of access to food, the distribution or maldistribution of natural resources, the degree to which those things create or exacerbate pandemics or epidemics. And those are very real causes, but they're slightly less visible to the average citizen. And what we know quite strongly, as Thomas suggests, is that the states that have the greatest capacity to withstand the deleterious effects of climate change are places like the United States and Canada and Japan that are already rich. The states that are likely to be most burdened, that will suffer the knock-on effects from migration and disease and lack of access to water and all these sorts of outcomes, are states that are already poor. And so what's likely to happen is an increased divide between safe, prosperous, secure states and the rest of the world. And that's dangerous for the entire fabric of global security writ large. And that's not a story that's getting a lot of telling, because folks, I think, are perhaps unduly focused on the false scenario of an uninhabitable planet, and we neglect the social consequences.
All right, listeners, 844-295-TALK if you want to weigh in, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263 9994. David on Twitter says, what's more cartoonish than something called a doomsday clock? Well, I kind of take the point here. And the international scientists from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists understand that sometimes there's going to be claims of politicization. So I want to hit this point because one of our listeners, Mark, emails me to say that are there any Republicans who agree with this kind of critique? First of all, Tom Nichols is a Republican who wrote a book about the death of expertise, and he's a professor at the Naval War College, and he wrote a piece for the Washington Post recently critiquing the Trump administration's first year. This is what Tom Nichols wrote in that Washington Post piece. Again, he describes himself as a longtime moderate Republican. He says, quote, Trump's tweets and off-the-cuff remarks have blown up a summit with Britain, deepened a standoff with North Korea, and precipitated a coming constitutional crisis within our government. It's all hilarious reality show stuff that doesn't matter right up until it does. This tendency is especially dangerous in foreign affairs, where Trump is laying down a legacy that will bedevil future presidents and endanger Americans for years to come. Trump taunts North Korea, and the North Koreans test more missiles, end quote. Wes, there's a lot to unpack with that critique, but let's start with that last point. There are some Trump supporters who say, good, it's finally time somebody became kind of the schoolyard bully when it comes to North Korea. Get on their level and speak to them in language they understand. Why not?
Mostly for the reason that I referenced earlier, that this type of, I think, loose talk significantly raises the chance of accidental escalation or conflict. I mean, it's not like we don't know where the North Koreans live and vice versa, and we have a very robust nuke arsenal. Everybody knows this. President Trump isn't actually saying anything that's not new with his talk and with his tweets. But when he suggests that the U.S. might actually be willing to use them or treats them in a cavalier way, that's a signal to folks in Pyongyang that they are insecure. And I don't know that there's much to be gained by that level of loose talk. We are already pretty secure as it is because we have a robust nuclear arsenal. But this level of discourse, or this low level of discourse, rather, I think does make it more likely that there will be an accidental escalation, and that's a really frightening outcome.
All right, so after our only break of the hour, I'll read some more of your comments that have come in, and I want to talk a little bit about Tom's work as an oceanographer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's
right.
been a lot of talk about sea level rise and what we can expect there, and I know some of your work has helped kind of glean some insight into whether at least what's been discussed publicly in many settings is accurate. Is it understating the risk and what the timeline might be with that? So as we discuss a so-called doomsday clock, I think it's important to try to get a grasp on why the international scientists who create this clock feel the way they do. They set the clock at 11:58 last month, 2 minutes to midnight, midnight being the possible extinction of mankind, putting a hop on your step on this Wednesday. But it's the latest in the hour it has ever been set. Well, it's high as the latest it's ever been set, and the latest it's been set since 1953. It was put at 11:58 in 1953 when the United States and the Soviet Union were testing nuclear arms on the same day. So that seemed bad for a scientific term. Well, now here we are back at 11:58, according to the international scientists, and we're going to delve more into where we stand climatologically. We'll also talk more about international relations. Another comment that the scientists made was that international diplomacy has been reduced to name-calling, giving it a surreal sense of unreality that makes the world security situation ever more threatening. We're going to see what Wes Renfro has to say about that, because some of Trump supporters say that's silly. We're not moving towards extinction because people call each other names. Well, we'll get more of your comments and more of our experts on the panel's thoughts on the matter after this only break of the hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, have you ever heard of the term the magical Negro? It's a term often credited to director Spike Lee, who says Hollywood too often uses one black character in a film as kind of a savior for white people or the white race, or it shows up in politics with people calling for Oprah or Michelle Obama to run for president. So, are there problems with it? What should we understand about it? A local art installation explores it. We'll talk about it next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about the possibility of mankind's extinction, the doomsday clock, that was created by a team of international scientists in 1947, was set last month. at 11:58, 2 minutes to midnight. And that is because the scientists say that we are at a precarious point in human history and that we have to get serious about nuclear weaponry, international security, climate change, first and foremost among them. And so here's Joel writing to the program and says, did your guest say something about the uninhabitable planet being a myth? Doesn't all of human history all fit within 2 minutes compared to the age of the Earth? In other words, I think Joel is saying, isn't it realistic that we should talk about the Earth becoming too warm to be inhabited by human beings? Tom?
You could talk about it. I mean, humans throughout human I certainly don't want to, you know, say anything definitive about how the Earth will become uninhabitable or not. But, you know, humans throughout their evolution have lived in some very different climate states than the one we're in right now, right? 100,000 years ago, the human diaspora was already pretty wide, and yet we're in the middle of an ice age, right? An ice age is a very different climate state to the climate we live in right now. So humans throughout their evolution have, you know, shown the ability to adapt either by, you know, changing the locations they live or coming up with new technologies. Humans can adapt to different climate states. I don't believe that the type of warming we predict over the next few hundred years is going to be enough to make the Earth uninhabitable to humans as a whole.
How about much more uncomfortable for humans?
Yeah,
as a whole?
we could go that far. Yeah.
Okay. And how about uninhabitable in some places where it's currently habitable? Is that
certainly
possible?
So coming back to like the island nations that I mentioned,
yep.
Some of those could easily become uninhabitable, either, you know, directly because sea level rise and changes in precipitation and temperature make their way of life impossible. Also, one of the main predictions of climate change is that it makes extreme weather events more likely, right? Last year, we saw certain island nations becoming uninhabitable because of very extreme weather events that, you know, climate change may have been a factor in producing those.
All right. So as an oceanographer, I want to hit 2 points then, because we hear a lot about the acidification of the oceans, which I know is right in your wheelhouse to discuss,
mm-hmm.
and also the question on sea level rise and what's likely, what's probable, what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with the latter. As you see it here, there's a lot of talk about water rising, what it means for coastal communities in the United States and around the world. What's happening now, and what is our expectation that's going to happen in the decades to come, as far out as we can see it right now?
Yeah, so our best understanding right now is that over the last 50 years, so since the 1950s, maybe since the 1950s, we've experienced about 20 centimeters, 0.2 meters of sea level rise. That's pretty well known. We have you know, long-term observations, both direct and satellite-based, to tell us that the sea level has risen that much. Kind of the range of expectations going out another 100 years is between an extra 0.2 meters up to a whole meter of additional sea level rise. So that's pretty significant, right? Compared to 1950, by the end of this century, the sea level could be a meter and a half higher than it was.
And that seems, let's just be myopic and talk about the United States, that seems like a lot of communities directly impacted and a big change in who can live where, yes?
Possibly a change in who can live where, certainly a change in the amount of resources, the amount of money that has to be spent in order to make places habitable, right? Coming back to the idea that countries with a lot of resources like the United States can generally find ways to adapt to the change in climate state. So in the United States, we'll likely be able to adapt, but it will be a drain on resources, right? The amount of money you have to spend to prevent low-lying areas flooding will be a drain on the economy.
If your friend wants to build on coastal property right now, are you telling them that's a bad idea?
I would probably be telling them that's a bad idea. Yeah, I'd say move up the cliff a little way.
It's kind of a flippant question, but are we at the point where we have to really evaluate what it means to have large numbers of people living in certain places and starting to slowly, if intentionally, shift those populations?
I think it's something that is already being thought about. All major cities, New York City, for example, has already been having to think about this. They have you know, plans and strategies for both how they're dealing with it right now and then over the next few years, how they're going to have to change their infrastructure, change the types of technologies they use to adapt to this. So it's something that's already being thought about at the local scale.
Okay. And acidification is something that is in your wheelhouse as a researcher.
Yes.
How does that relate to what's happening in, is that tied to other aspects of climate change and what's going on with acidification of the ocean?
So ocean acidification is interesting because it's not a consequence of the warming of the Earth as a whole. It's a consequence of CO2 building up in the atmosphere. So CO2 is, of course, causing the global warming, but acidification is another direct consequence of CO2 building up in the atmosphere. CO2 dissolves in water, forms carbonic acid. That's a weak acid, like is found in soft drinks. As more CO2 builds up in the atmosphere, more dissolves in the ocean, and the ocean is becoming more acidic over time. This is something we've been able to measure directly. We know that it has occurred for at least the last 20, 30 years, and our best projections show it, the trend continuing into the future.
And then so what?
Yeah, so that's a question that often comes,
I ask because I'm so uneducated on this.
Yeah, so what if the ocean becomes more acidic? So what are the direct effects on humans? Not many, right? There's organisms in the ocean that really care about how acidic it becomes, the main one being coral reefs, right? Coral reefs are made of calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate dissolves in acids. As the ocean becomes more acidic, it becomes harder for coral reefs to exist, to build their calcium carbonate shells. And then coming back to it, the effect on humans, a lot of the fish that we eat from the ocean are dependent on coral reefs. Coral reef ecosystems are the most vibrant ocean ecosystems of all, if you like. And there's a lot of countries, a lot of regions whose entire food strategy revolves around these very diverse fisheries that exist in coral reef environments.
All right. So then let's just talk about the fact that in the last year, the question is action. And why did this Bulletin of Atomic Scientists set the doomsday clock forward when it comes to climate change? They don't see action going on. So if all of this impacts sort of each other, if acidification of the ocean continues apace here, if we are impacted in our food sources, where we can live, if sea levels rise, if the planet continues to warm, if we see higher precipitation events, all of these things tied to climate are happening. I guess if acidification, let's just take that, if it's happening because of CO2 in the atmosphere, that's related to what we're burning in terms of fossil fuels. I mean, it seems simple enough, no?
It's absolutely directly related.
So just burn fewer fossil fuels and the acidification slows? That's likely?
Yeah, so we can think of the acidification of the ocean just being tied to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. In order to prevent or reverse the acidification, we would have to lower the atmospheric CO2 concentration, which in turn requires that we emit less CO2 from our industrial sources, burning of fossil fuels.
Directly related and pretty simple to address if we made a choice, if we did that. Okay.
Yeah, we could argue about how economically easy it is to scale back fossil fuels. That's always the counter argument coming from the other side.
No question. Right? I say easy in that we know there is a direct relationship and we know that if we made that change, there would be an impact.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. The observed acidification we know is due to the CO2 we've emitted. So
okay, and that's what I mean by easy. Tom's right. Professor Tom Weber is right. I mean, there is a counter argument that says it's easy in theory. In practice, it's complex. I get that. But Wes Renfro, let's go back to then the question of international leadership, because one of the things they tried to accomplish in Paris is set some sort of a beginning first step towards slowing slowing warming and addressing some of these things, understanding that it requires international cooperation and leadership, especially from the big guys and from the big polluters, the United States, India, China, among them. And the scientists who create the Doomsday Clock, West, say they are alarmed at the lack of international leadership and regard for the American presidency now. How do you see it?
So the three causes of global catastrophe that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists cites, I'm actually most concerned with this third. this sort of slow unraveling of the post-World War II order. And I just want to point out that we're going on three quarters of a century of peace between the world's great powers, and that is historically anomalous, to say the least. And when you look at the post-World War II settlement, it was intentionally crafted to create institutions and norms which would prevent the types of conflict that bedeviled the world in the first half of the 20th century. And that order is largely built around a willing United States, a United States that is sometimes willing to burden individual costs for the greater good, that the United States can help impose order, that the United States will not only work for its own narrow interests in the short term, but also for interests of folks in other parts of the planet. And what is truly remarkable and I think dangerous is the degree to which we have stepped away from the post-World War II consensus. And I think that the lack of action on climate change and also the moving away from TPP are the best, most recent illustrations of how this administration feels about internationalism. And I think that there's a lot of folks who say, well, it's time to put America first. But I think a more thoughtful reflection suggests that if we don't put questions of order and global security first, the United States won't be in great shape anyways.
Now, I'm thinking of libertarians. I'm thinking of people who feel like we have had too much of a role in international affairs, Wes. And I know you encounter those arguments. What is the short explanation for those who say we are overextended and our leadership role in the world overextends us in a way that hurts our own interests and is not really effective on an international scale?
So I think a lot of folks, in particular libertarians, say, well, the costs of internationalism are high, therefore this is not a policy that is advantageous to the United States. But I think that that sort of thinking misses the bigger and more important question: what are the costs of the United States not participating? And if that sort of means a return to a world of the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must, the costs, for example, of things like the First World War or the Second World War, the costs of things like allowing climate change to go unmitigated, are catastrophic in comparison with the amount of funding and resources that it takes to promote the cause of internationalism.
Angela writes to the program and just says, look at the impact of the scare in Hawaii recently. The world will have true terror if we see nuclear war, and for my own children, that has always been my biggest concern. That's from Angela. John writes to the program and says, this subject is very near and dear to me. I work in the NICU, and the amount of waste we create every day is amazing. I have now become a one-issue voter, I assume. He says candidate. I assume he means voter. I've now become a one-issue voter. I feel like I'm forced to exist in this society, grown up within a throwaway culture, and with very little way of working out of it. Is there any literature or resource that could actually help a family find ways that they can break out of this throwaway culture mode? That's from John. And Tom, that's a big question, asking a scientist who says, I'm just an oceanographer, leave me out of this. but I understand. I mean, I take his point here. I mean, if we actually stopped and tried to get our head around the amount of waste we produce, it can feel overwhelming at times. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you're right. It is a big question. It's something that, you know, there's kind of two ways that we might think about it, right? On an individual level, what can we do? And then, like your viewer suggested, we can also make political decisions about, you know, who to vote in, who has the best ideas about how to deal with this. On a individual basis, I get the impression that, you know, there's always more that we can do. We can, you know, be very careful about what we recycle, what we compost. I've seen a few documentaries about people trying to move, you know, on an individual level towards a zero waste household, if you like. It seems like, you know, it's a very hard thing to do. You have to, you know, it's a big investment to make as an individual. But yeah, I do think everybody should be, we should try to be more careful about what we recycle, what we compost, but the bigger decisions probably need to be made at a governmental level, right? What are we going to do to make it easier for people to live that kind of lifestyle?
Yeah, I think, you know, John may hear recycling, composting, and it might seem like sort of small potatoes in a world where he feels that it's sort of a waste culture. I think individually it takes intentionality in just about every place that you, so wherever your workplace is, what is your workspace and what are you wasting in your workspace? Mm-hmm. And in your home space, how much waste you're generating. If you're not thinking about that at just about every level, individually, it's probably we're probably going to be wasting more than we need to. And that's a lot to ask people. I'm not saying we shouldn't.
Seems like something that has to be constantly present in your mind, right? On an individual level, I try to be very conscious about what I recycle, what I compost. But, you know, in the, you know, the busy to and fro of everyday life, you find yourself just throwing something away. And then you think back on it later that I shouldn't have done that. But at that time, you know, this wasn't forefront in my mind. And it has to be constantly if you want to try and live that lifestyle. So, broader things that can be done, making these type of recycling receptacles, composting receptacles more available, more widespread. You know, I think that there has to be efforts to make it easier for people to do this, because otherwise they won't, because of how constantly that has to be in your mind.
Living. And now I'm thinking back to the way Wes Renfro, the chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College, made the point that climate science does tie to international security. There's a lot of intersection here. When it comes to what Tom is saying here in response to our listener, John, and his concerns about our waste culture, Tom is right that if we are intentional at every level and we're thinking about everything, that maybe we're able to kind of pull off a less waste culture. But the problem kind of gets bigger than us. And Wes, I think the problem gets away from us on an individual level when we have so much economic inequality. I mean, I am more advantaged to think about these things as opposed to someone working multiple jobs or living in poverty or trying to get by day to day. And then you ask him, what are you doing about climate change on a daily basis? I think, Wes, that we are loading too much on a population when there's inequality, and that maybe climate gets away from us too when there's more inequality. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I certainly think that it does. And I also sort of want to point out that you can't have your cake and eat it too. And, you know, middle class Americans and upper middle class Americans oftentimes, I think, want to do things about climate change and want to improve the quality of the environment, but then engage on, you know, a daily level and activities and behaviors that are, you know, nearly catastrophic. Folks owning 3,500 square feet homes, not living in dense urban corridors, taking vacations that necessitate lots and lots and lots of air travel. And so I think that on a social level, a purely social level, the U.S. doesn't do a particularly good job in the upper stratas of society of putting their money where their mouths are when in terms of individual behaviors or enacting smart climate policy.
Joan in Hilton on the line has a question for us. Go ahead, Joan.
Yes, I live on Lake Ontario, and we're always wondering, with the ocean levels, will that rise Lake Ontario level also if it goes up? Because we are higher, 246 feet, I believe, above sea level. So I'm not sure that in itself would raise our level.
Tom Weber, any idea?
I couldn't give a definitive answer on that. I mean, a lot of sea level rise is due to melting of ice caps, right? So as polar ice caps melt, the water feeds into the oceans and the sea level rises. I don't know any particular projections about how lake levels are going to rise, but sea level rise I generally think of as a more kind of global oceanic issue. I couldn't give a definitive answer on
before
that.
I go back to Joan just to kind of see if she has a follow-up, let me ask you, Tom, because there has been, particularly last spring, winter and spring, you know, a lot of flooding issues locally on the lake. Forget where the oceans are. There were questions on precipitation. So if we continue to see higher precipitation events, which I think my understanding is not every single weather event is tied to climate change,
sure.
But more broadly speaking, when there's more moisture in the atmosphere, when we do have precipitation events, they tend to be more snow or more rain than they would. So an inch of rain is maybe an inch and a half. Or in Buffalo, they had 3 feet of snow in 24 hours. It might have been 18 inches before. So again, I try to be careful not to tie every single event to climate change. But broadly speaking, do we see more moisture in the atmosphere and thus more precipitation events, higher precipitation?
Yeah, so the broad trend both observed over the last 50 years and projected for the next 100 years is that the northern mid-latitudes, which is where we live, will become rainier in general. And that's just a consequence of a warmer atmosphere, evaporates more water, you get a more active hydrological cycle and more rain.
And more of a challenge to control lake levels, I would assume?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so flooding issues, and then just also broader issues tied to, you know, whether the structures we've built for a particular climate system can survive the new climate system we're moving into.
All right, Joan, any follow-up there?
Yeah, no, I just knew that we have to worry about the rain, but I didn't know we have to worry about ocean levels, too, on the lake. You know, we're kind of tied to the ocean a little bit, but we're still higher than sea level.
Yeah, Joan, thank you. And I think just there are a lot of moving parts, and it sounds very difficult to immediately connect one thing directly to another, but there's a lot of interactivity, I think. And what it sounds like I'm learning from Tom Weber, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester this hour, is, you know, if you want to look at why things like the doomsday clock are set closer to midnight, it's because there hasn't been the kind of action that is going to produce the kind of change to slow it down significantly or to halt climate change, to halt warming, to halt acidification of oceans, to change the kind of impact here. And we've got to get more serious about fossil fuel burning. That's directly related, as Tom pointed out. Not easy, but on the policy side, it requires real leadership. Wes Renfro, does the American populace have the appetite for that kind of a change and what it might take for a little while? I mean, we're pretty innovative as a society. We went from horse and buggies to gas stations on most corners in a few decades, but making another change away from that could cause a little economic pain in the short term. I mean, can we envision a scenario where Americans say, okay, we're going to suck up the economic pain for now because this is for the greater good, or do we have to package it in a way that says we can do both? We can have a thriving economy and a better impact on climate.
You know, it's really difficult to get people on board when they are in particular feeling like their own financial situation is not secure. That's at root a collective action problem, and that's really difficult to do. To that, I would add that there has been a tendency, in particular, I think, in the United States, for folks to rely on innovation as a solution or as a means to mitigate all sorts of problems, including climate change. And I think that that's fine when it works, but that, you know, we have to realistically consider the scenario under which folks were not willing to pay for the cost of mitigating against climate change, and innovation did not work out. When I think about the range of outcomes, that's really the most frightening one for me, and I think that it's quite real.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've got listeners who work with groups like the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, and they work in climate action, and they are very, very much adamant that we can shift our economy, we can innovate, and we can do it in a way that we can thrive. Look at the solar industry. Solar installation is one of the fastest growing industries in this country. And we know that there are jobs out there if we want to innovate in certain directions. I think what I'm hearing from you, Wes, is that is all well and good, but if we want to truly impact climate, it can't just be with the mindset that says, well, okay, only if it's good for the economy, because we're going to have missteps, and if we fail, then we're just going to stop.
Yeah, and the entire notion that innovation will be a panacea to all the problems caused by climate change, I'm a little skeptical of that. Even if we can grow some jobs in new sectors, I think there's things in the social and political world that we're not talking about, like can we live at a more simple and sustainable level? That's something that we don't oftentimes engage with. Do we need to have the same patterns of consumption? And this, I think, speaks to some of the questions that earlier callers raised. I think our general collective thinking has been, well, let's keep high levels of consumption, but let's somehow do it greener and let's do it via innovation. But we're not talking about perhaps reducing the things that we use.
Yeah, we may have to understand that we have to live in smaller houses or live in more densely clustered communities and significant changes. And that's a lot to get your head around. So, Wes, 25 seconds. In the next year, the doomsday clock will be set back, not ahead toward midnight, if what?
If the U.S. manages to keep the status quo with the Iran deal and there's no conflict on the Korean border.
Okay. Tom Weber from the University of Rochester. On the climate side, what will help?
I think it has to come from the U.S., and I think it has to be the U.S. recommitting to the Paris Climate Accord and this administration making it clear that they're going to take seriously advice from scientists. I think appointing a White House science advisor would be a nice first step that we'd like to see.
I'd like to ask you if you're optimistic about that happening.
I am not.
Okay. Tom Weber is a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Thanks for your expertise. It's been great having you here, Tom. Thank you
for having me.
Wes Renfro from the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies, the chair at St. John Fisher College. Always good, Wes. Thanks for doing it, and I know we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Listeners, I want to tell you that we're in the middle of our winter membership campaign. And as we get ready to move into our second hour of Connections today, just want to let you know, we want you to call us, 454-6300. That's not the show number. That's the number our volunteers are staffing for us, because we are in day three of a membership campaign. We've got a long, long way to go. Help us get there. These are the kinds of conversations we try to have in depth. We try to bring in multiple voices. We try to answer your questions and bring in your perspectives, consider all kinds of new information and evidence. And we do that because you support us. If you're a Connections listener regularly and you're not a member, do me a favor. Do the host solid. Change it right now. 454-6300. Thanks for doing that. Let's get a short break. More Connections coming up.